Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a show about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pollain. I'm a design leadership coach, service design and innovation consultant, educator, and writer. My guest today is Aparna Ray, an educator by training, innovator by chance, and disruptor by choice, who loves to solve problems, connect people, and build power. She is an award-winning multi-startup founder and founder of Moving Beyond, leveraging data to create workplaces that work for everyone, building products that solve complex DEI and people challenges, using real-time employee voice and impact data grounded in human-centered design. In 2021, she joined a cadre of female founders, just 2% of all women-owned businesses whose companies reached $1 million in revenue. Aparna, welcome to Power of 10.
Thanks for inviting me, Andy.
Well, that's quite a bio. I'm interested always to know how people got to where they are and what their journey is. So, you know, what was your journey to where you are now?
Yeah, it's been a meandering journey. I spent the first decade of my career in education, and I went, you know, like I went to college to become a public school teacher. And after a year of teaching, I realized I wasn't going to be happy, and I wasn't going to be impactful as a public school teacher. And yeah, and it just kind of started me on a path of entrepreneurship. I created my very first startup 10 years ago, building a workforce development program for immigrant refugee women, and then did a stint in India, upskilling teachers there, and came back to the US in 2017 at a time when there was a lot of movement following the following Trump winning the elections. And I think there was a moment where a lot of people were asking themselves, like, how we do better so that we don't find ourselves in this situation again. And it created an opening for me to have conversations that I, you know, like, was only having in a small group, right? Like one of our like hush like communities, and start to scale it up. And the ideas really were like, how do we surface data that highlight the experiences people are having so that the experiences of folks that are underrepresented at work. And for me, you know, the journey really started with activating women of color in the US and growing from there. But in 2020, I started Moving Beyond because I noticed that a lot of organizations that were setting out to build tools and resources and programs and strategies for employee engagement and for DE&I were not actually considering the state of the state. And you know this, right? Yeah. Like you've been at work a really long time. We can't bury the experiences of people in aggregates. You know, we can't say that, you know, 80% of our organization feels a sense of belonging when people of color don't feel that, when immigrants don't feel that. And so, yeah, that's how I got to building Moving Beyond. And now I am in the process of planning a sabbatical year and taking a break from this work and this phase of my life.
So I'm sure it's well earned, that's for sure, and given everything you've been doing so far. Where have you kind of found yourself in terms of, do you feel like sort of saturated with kind of everything you've been doing, and it's and you just want a clear head? Or I talk to a lot of leaders, obviously, and that's part of my job as a design leadership coach. And there is a kind of a point where you're like, well, I need some space to think.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things, right? Like we've just lived through a really intense period in our lives. I don't even know that I can say that we've lived through it. We're living through a global pandemic. And so I think it's fair to say that a lot of us are burnt out, and those of us that have been trying to shift cultures and systems inside of organizations that are so hard and so sticky, there's an element of burnout. And so there's definitely one piece of it, which is I'm tired and I've been feeling burnt out because of the kind of work that we've been doing over the last couple of years. And then there's an element of wanting some space to think. When I started Moving Beyond almost 4 years ago, I felt like I was clear that data was the answer. You know, I just believed in it so, so much. And in fact, like at the peak of companies coming to us and asking us to help them build out DE&I programs and train their employees and coach their leaders, we were saying, actually, no, like we don't do this, right? Like we're not going to walk in and train folks without knowing how people are experiencing the organization, like how people are thinking and feeling. Mm. And we were really firm at the cost of millions of dollars in potential revenue. Like we just said no to a lot of people that weren't going to use data, right? That's how firm I felt in the belief that data was going to solve a lot of these challenges. And now kind of at the end of these 4 years, I'm realizing that it's just not enough. You know, I'm looking back at the 55 companies that we've worked with and noticing where there are successes. And I think, yes, like for sure, having some good information, right? Like some good, reliable information to make decisions on is important. I would never say that it's not important, and it's not enough. Because ultimately, the places and spaces where we have been the most successful are ones where the leaders already believed in the importance of taking care of their people in like humanity, in, you know, stretching budgets so that folks were not having to make the decision between paying their rent and feeding themselves, which is very much a reality for tens of millions of folks in the United States and, like, honestly, like all over the world, right? But specifically all over the like high income, like Western world. Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah. So I'm going to take some time off to really think about, you know, what's next for me, but also, you know, try and get my head around if data is not going to solve the problems, if like a widget and right, all of the tools and technologies are not going to solve some of these problems, then what is, and is it possible to do it at scale?
There's obviously a whole group of people who are banking on AI is going to solve it all and everything will be happy, right?
No, I don't know that I'm one of those people.
No, nor am I. I guess there's a, you know, I'd like to sort of go back to one thing. We talked a little bit when we had talked once before the show that about this idea of kind of fear and anxiety in stakeholders. And there's two bits to it when you say data's not enough, which is, you know, the thing I encountered over and over again with working with coaches or working with clients is the desire, you know, and whatever it was, right? It might have been DE&I initiatives, or it might have been, you know, some innovation thing, or whatever it was they were trying to change in some way. Let's put it that way. There was some change that they were trying to achieve, and there was either a kind of like shrug of helplessness at this aspect of structural change, or there was, oh, well, that's kind of just off limits, or there was fear and anxiety, or kind of all three. So I'm kind of interested there, because it feels to me like, yes, the data is important, but I would guess it also leads to, you need some structural change. You can't kind of keep things like, whether it's incentives or hiring processes or, you know, a number of other things the same, and expect then to just be able to kind of bolt some extra stuff on the top. How did you find leadership of those organizations in terms of their appetite and fear for structural change? And is my hypothesis, you know, do you agree with that, what I'm saying?
I like wholeheartedly agree with it. Absolutely. You know, we need structural change. We also need to be in compliance with the various laws of the land.
The stuff that already exists. Yeah.
The stuff that already exists, right? And so I often talk about pay equity, both with my clients, but also, you know, as an advocate in the community. And the thing is that, like, pay equity is actually the law of the land.
Yeah.
You should be doing it. And because it's not a thing for which there are consequences, right? Like, if you don't do it, there's no consequences, because this information is not transparent. This information is not transparent. Companies are getting away with it and have been getting away with it and are going to continue to get away with it. Our governments, like, whether it's here in the US or in the UK or, like, honestly anywhere, right? Like, the government knows when you're not in compliance, just like the government knows, like, when you haven't paid your taxes and they can come get you. And why, like, you know, for me, I think the question often is, like, why isn't it important? I think the reason that it's not important is who is getting underpaid typically tends to be women. It tends to be immigrants. It tends to be people with disabilities. Where in the United States, like, you don't even have to pay a minimum wage to somebody that has disabilities. There are lots of carve outs and caveats for that. Like, we don't have to pay young people, right? Like, an equitable salary. And so I would say companies need to start with doing some of those things. And in the absence of, you know, regulatory behaviors, like, you should do the honor system. And the honor system is that you do things like pay equity. When it comes to things like hiring, that's, you know, again, like, in the US, it's the law to make sure that the way in which you're advertising jobs and the ways in which you're hiring people doesn't discriminate against folks. And you and I both know that, like, the way in which hiring happens is through a system of referrals, which systematically disadvantages people that are not currently in the circle, right?
Yeah.
If I don't know about it, there's no way for me to ask you to put in a referral for me, right? And so, yes, like, we need better systems, we need better processes. And I think this is actually where, when they're built well, AI can go a long way. A colleague of mine in the Seattle area is building, you know, I think in some ways, like, really simple technology that even just helps hiring managers see how they interview people differently on the basis of gender and race and ethnicity. And one of the things that they found is, across the board, right, it's like sector agnostic, but across the board, hiring managers are allowing female candidates to speak somewhere between 6 and 9 fewer minutes than men.
Wow.
In a 30-minute interview. So if somebody in a 30-minute interview is getting to speak, let's say, let's even be on, like, the conservative, right, end of it, 6 minutes less. Well, that's like 6 minutes less of information that they're going to be able to share or answer your questions. And that's important to know.
Like,
that's important to know. So I think that there's that piece, right? Like, we can use technology to address some systems change, but I think ultimately when I think about change from a 30 or maybe a 50,000 foot view, then we're looking at a world where more women and more people of color are in positions of leadership because they've been promoted equitably, because they've been paid equitably. And I think that a lot of the fear and anxiety, whether it's articulated or not, comes from the fact that people who have been in positions of power can see and feel that working differently is going to have different outcomes, right? Yeah. And who's in the corner office and who's in the boardroom is going to have to change. How does it not change, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there is a, there's a common, it's a really crass question. I'm almost embarrassed to kind of ask you it, but it comes up often enough that I feel like I'd love to hear your answer to it, which is this idea of yes, but either there's something like what's the return on investment of doing this, or there's yes, but, when we're, if we have two people who are, it's always framed in this way, which is if we have someone who is, doesn't look like me, not a white middle-class male, middle-aged male, and someone who's not that but is then less qualified, should we be promoting the one who's less qualified? And it always seems to be that that's a straw man, that second one. But just because it comes up so often, I'd really like to hear your answer to it. I know I think it's a bit of a rubbish question, actually.
If the people that have been getting promoted were in fact qualified, I think we would have fewer problems.
That's such a good answer. That's such a good answer. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah, okay.
I think that, this is like many, many, many years ago. When I was in grad school, I had a professor. I was like probably at a conference, and somebody said, stereotypes don't come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Right. There's an element, there's a basis of truth in a stereotype, right? So whether it is women crossing the street when they see a group of men walking towards them, right? And the stereotype is that, like, you might be violent. And so I'm taking precautions and I'm putting myself out of harm's way. And like, hopefully, we get to live in a world where like that's not going to be the case, right? Like where I can cross paths with like, let's say, four men when I'm a single woman walking on the street, and they're not going to do anything except maybe smile at me and say hello, right? Yeah, like, or maybe even walk me to my car. But there is a kernel of truth in a lot of stereotypes. And there is one about mediocre white men running things, and they're not that good. Yeah. Like they're not actually good at it. You also asked this question, right? Which I think it's a rubbish question, not because you asked because it's a question that distracts us from what the work is. And this question of like, well, what's the return on investment? And I would say, for whom?
Yeah.
I think the return on investment of having really deep inequity, which shows up as income inequality, which shows up as grossly underfunded or unavailable social safety net systems in many places of the world, is it really works for a small group of people, and it works for a homogenous group of people. And so, yeah, like shifting our systems to be more equitable, to be more fair, to be more just. And honestly, at the end of the day, like to not take dignity and humanity away from people, which is what I think ultimately is at risk when we're forcing people to choose between, rent and food or heating and food, is that world, that more humane world, actually offers better returns for women. It offers better returns for immigrants, for queer folks, for disabled folks. It doesn't for the white men that are at the top of the pyramid, or right, like class privileged men. If we want to like look beyond the white Western world, like places in India, China, right, like class privileged folks are in these positions of leadership. It doesn't. The return on investment isn't there for them.
Yeah. You You've reminded me of this book by, Thomas Chamara Premizik. I don't know if you know of it. You probably may do.
I don't.
It's called, he's written quite a lot about this. And there's a really good podcast, actually. It's called The Broad Experience, and it's about women's experience at work. And he was on there, and I never get over the title, so good. You know, why do so many incompetent men become leaders? You know, and the main premise of it is everything you already know, which is kind of what you've just said. But some of it was also, you know, men tend to put themselves forward for stuff that they don't have any idea about how to do, but they can see it's advantageous when women are generally socialized not to do that. And so that just gradually creates this kind of shift. The reason why I also asked that question, though, was, you know, there what you just talked about before at the beginning, you know, in 2017, there was this kind of upswell of, and Black Lives Matter had been going for quite some time, but there was a sudden kind of awareness of it, and obviously all the protests in the States and stuff, in fact, around the world. And everyone put in their DEI initiatives, and then, as most of us probably know, quite a lot of the big tech companies in particular, but I think it's happened elsewhere, in the name of, you know, efficiencies and, you know, things are getting tight, which in the States is not actually the case, right? The economy is, in fact, doing okay. But, you know, with the prospect of perhaps it might not, and all the layoffs, those DEI teams have been some of the first to go, right?
Yeah.
And so hence the kind of ROI question, I guess. That's why. I think it is a crappy question, though. There was a really good I think it's by Tom Fishburne. He's a cartoonist. His website, I think, is called The Marketoonist. I'll try and find it later. And there was a cartoon, and there's a sort of an audience. There's someone on stage, and they're saying, and they've got a slide up that says, you know, sustainable planet, income equity, and all of these other kind of social justice issues. And there's someone in the audience going, but what happens if this is all a hoax and if we're just building a better world for nothing? It's very good. It's a very astute cartoon, which you kind of feel like that's where you're kind of going with this. It's like, why wouldn't you? We know why.
I ask myself that all the time. And, you know, I have a couple of friends that left the world of big finance and are now on their own path of figuring out what they want to do in life. And one of the things that, you know, a friend and colleague of mine, Sam Ushio, shared with me is the law dictates that a company prioritize shareholders over just about everything else, right? So they're not... I mean, well, like they can, but they can also get sued for prioritizing employee well-being at the cost of, let's say, slower growth for shareholders. And then I think about like, well, who owns shares, you know, and a really small handful of people own the bulk of the equity in the Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies, right? These large cap publicly traded companies. But I think even in privately held companies or nonprofit organizations, there's such a gross disparity. And I'm starting to think that like this is a way for people to keep us locked into systems. And I'm not the only person thinking this, right? Into systems where we're so tired. Like we don't actually have time for activism. I mean, what stands out about 2020 in the summer where people were having protests around the world, right? Not just the United States, but George Floyd's murder sparks something. And it's because so many of us were not working. It's because so many people were not working, and it created a moment to pause and reflect and engage. And there were masses on the streets. Mm. So we need the time and the space to be able to do that. I also, you know, big fan of Octavia Butler's work. Black sci-fi author, such an incredible thinker. And there's an interview with her from, I think, sometime in the 90s, you know, where people are asking her, you know, why are you advocating for taxing homes of people who don't have kids? Because in the United States, it's the tax on homes funds schools.
Yeah.
And yep. And it's, I think it's after she wrote The Parables, is, and she says, look, like, I don't want to live in a society where people are illiterate, because literacy is a path to civic engagement. Literacy is a path to innovation. Literacy is a path to having a more equitable society. Yeah. So I'm happy to pay my taxes because it means that I am in a literate world. Right. And that's what I come back to is, you know, when people say, well, like, why should I care, or why should I do it, or what do I have to gain from it? I think, like, what anybody has to gain from it is, like, happier people, like nicer, cleaner cities, like better public transportation, you know, probably less violence.
Yeah. Yeah. I just before recording, actually, I was speaking to a student of mine. Excuse me. And she's working on a project about people in the Philippines gaining access to financial aid when they have cancer. Things that she's identified is that, you know, there's a sort of process thing there. So they have to go and make an application, they have to go and be assessed. But that means they have to go to the clinic to be assessed. There's no kind of booking mechanism by which they can kind of book in times. And there's also a kind of cutoff at the other end. So what happens is people get up at like 4 a.m. Everyone goes there. And so these are all people who have got some compromised people who are going to have to kind of pile in at the same time. And then because of the nature of it, they might have multiple sources of income, of assessment. And so they have to kind of go through this several times. And it's one of those things where, and you're saying, hey, well, you just need to apply for this thing without the thought going into what does that actually mean for those people to do that, right? So this is people who are self-identifying as pretty much being in poverty, saying you need to get on a bus, you need to then spend your whole day, and you probably may need to come with someone to come here, and we're going to kind of put you through this over and over again. So, and it's just what, for me, from a service design perspective, that's one of those intensely frustrating things where I kind of think, you know, that's not even, you know, upstream, there's obviously, it'd be great if the meds were free, right? And then upstream from that, you know, it'd be great if there's no cancer. But those are sort of, well, the meds for free thing is a designable thing. That's a policy choice, right? But that sort of process area of things where you just make it incredibly difficult for people. And there's a kind of, well, that's just the way it is, you know, drives me absolutely nuts. Because those feel to me, those are kind of powerful levers. And I'm interested in the work you've done. And we've mentioned before about the sort of systems effect of things and that kind of systems thinking. Obviously, in that sort of methodology or that mindset, there's this idea of having different levers in a system. And I'm really interested to know what you have found has been the most sort of powerful lever that's actually something that you can push upon, you know, versus, you know, laddering up to, well, you know, capitalism, it's broken, you know. Which it is, right?
So, which,
know,
it is.
Yeah. And so, you know, you can sort of drip away at that. But, you know, at the organizational level, I'm really interested to know what you've found, you know, that has been one of the most sort of powerful, potent levers to push on to create change.
Transparency.
That came around like a shot. Okay. Tell me more.
Yeah. So, you know, in 2019, this is my last startup, and Future for Us. We started with doing a program called State of Women of Color, and it was, you know, I would say, like, in part because I love data and I read a lot of reports and I am glued to the news, and I also enjoy humor. So it was a little bit of, I'm not going to call it a stand-up, but you know, it was a little bit of like, here's what's happening in the world, right? Like, this is how it impacts you. And I remember that after every single one of the State of Women of Colors, there would be dozens of people who would walk up to me and they would say, I had no idea. I had no idea that 80% of people are hired from referrals. Gosh, like if I had known that, I would be referring a lot of people. Or yeah. I had no idea the state of income inequality. I had no idea that less than 2% of female founders ever, right? Like, and we're talking lifetime revenue yeah. of $1 million ever hit. 2% hit a lifetime revenue of $1 million. And $1 million is not a lot of money.
No.
And so many of them, or like promotion, right? Promotion velocity. Like I had no idea that men in my company were getting promoted faster than women. Like I've always felt it, but I just didn't know that that was actually what was happening. And so I think that transparency is really powerful. Transparency is really powerful. How we get there is hard and tricky, and data can be manipulated in all the ways.
Yeah, yeah,
right. Sure. Like data can be manipulated in a lot of different ways. But I think at the end of the day, like transparency.
It also triggers a lot of fear and anxiety, obviously, transparency. I guess that's the sort of resistance to it as well. You said something there. You said, oh, it's a bit like a stand-up, which made me think, you know, there's a thing that's going on that's been, you know, plaguing climate scientists for ages. It's kind of not like we don't know, right, the problems. And they tend towards, if people just knew the data more, if people just knew more stats and facts and figures, they would change their behavior. And as we know, none of us do. Or, you know, we want our cake and eat it. I'm interested in and then it takes a sort of David Attenborough Blue Planet documentary where there's a seahorse with an earbud kind of around its tail, or, you know, a polar bear on a piece of ice. And it's that immediately hooks people. And everyone's, oh, my God, we need to kind of get rid of plastics. Well, that's a conversation that's sort of gone away again as well. I'm interested in the storytelling aspect of what you just talked about, because it feels to me like that landed in a way. You could have gone up and said, here are the stats, and sent that out, and you probably did. But somehow that landed with people more than maybe just doing that. And I'm interested to know what you felt about the way you did that was a thing that landed in a way that maybe just, you know, facts and figures on their own don't.
I think that we have to... So before I say what I was going to say, I'm going to say, like, the reason that I am so drawn to sci-fi is because there is, and fiction, right? Yeah. And fiction in general. And I'm a voracious reader, is because it transports you into a different reality. Right? You have an opportunity to put yourself somewhere else and try it on. Like, do I want to live on Mars? I don't know. But no. When I'm reading, when I'm reading The Martian, yeah, I mean, my answer is also no. My answer is also
Elon Musk is there. That's why I don't want to go.
Well,
sorry.
Even if he wasn't there, it just feels like, you know, I live in the Pacific Northwest, which is lush and green all year round. And we have our mountains and we have so much water, and just like imagining, right? And I think for me, it's like imagining not having that. Feels really hard. I can't imagine living on Mars unless we can figure out how to terraform it. And so you have to help people imagine. You have to help them draw the through line of consequences for themselves, for their families, for people that they care about. And I think, you know, the climate issue is, it's actually, well, I'm like, a lot of folks will say, well, it's really complex. And I think ultimately it's not really that complex. We have really intense, powerful companies lobbying to keep us from innovating. And I'm also going to say that the way in which they're forcing us to use our time makes us so reliant on the products that degrade our climate. Right? I think like in the United, like the US, absolutely. You know, geographically is so huge.
Yeah.
It's not like Europe or I think even Southeast Asia where you can get on a train and you're going to be in a different country 90 minutes later. That's not the case here. Like I can get on a train and 90 minutes later, I'm still in the US. Right? I'm still like probably just in the state that I started in. And so, for instance, you know, we take flights everywhere if we need to travel because it's the fastest way to travel. But the reason that we're prioritizing speed is because we only get 10 days of holidays.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so if I want to maximize time with my friends or family or rest or whatever, then I'm taking a flight because that's the fastest way. Or I'm buying individually wrapped snacks and all kinds of things. Yeah. But why am I doing it?
Yeah.
I'm doing it because I need the convenience because I probably have 5 minutes to pack school lunches or my own lunch. And then I have to be on the road. So I'm not going to be, you know, putting things in a little Tupperware. And then I have the Tupperware that I have to clean.
Yeah.
So we're hooked. We're like beholden to crap that we don't need, packaged in things that are killing the planet because we're just working all the time.
Yeah.
We're working all the, I mean, I don't know if you have it where you live, but at my grocery store, there is not only cut fruit, which I just find actually so disgusting.
Yes.
So disgusting. But there's also things like pre-chopped onions.
Oh no, that's not quite that bad here, but.
I'm sorry, why can you not chop an onion? And by the way, like your onion is just gonna be, like it's gonna live longer, right? Like it's gonna be edible longer if you didn't cut it.
Yeah, speed and convenience are particularly pernicious. And I think that, you know, convenience is, things that are sold as convenience often aren't, you know, and I guess in that systems effect, obviously, you know, one person's convenience then makes an inconvenience for someone else. I mean, you're just kind of pushing the problem around. But the speed out of all things, you know, this idea of the sort of cult of productivity and speed, I think it's, you know, some of it has come, a lot of it has come from tech. You know, that's mm-hmm. and they're obviously the most successful industries in the world at the moment. So, you know, let's do more of that, you know, regardless of the consequences. But the speed thing, I just think is kind of, I constantly can come back to this thing of why, you know, there's a premise there that faster is better and working faster is better. And, you know, whether it's, you know, producing apps and products and the rest of it faster. And, you know, Amazon now release code, you know, once every second. You know, it's kind of absurd versus... And the premise of that is never questioned, of why is faster better, you know, and it drives me nuts. Talking of speed and then of slowing down, I don't know if it's too early to ask, do you have any plans for your sabbatical or are you just going to have a bit of time to think about that?
I have a rough draft.
You don't have to say, don't have to let the cat out of the bag or the energy out of it yet if you don't want to.
No, I have a rough draft. Okay, so I'm one of these people that puts together a spreadsheet, even if I'm going on a 4-day vacation. You know, there's like start time, end times, the plan, but the plan B if it's raining.
I bet you're and fun to be on vacation with.
You know what? I'm actually fun to be on vacation because I'm prepared.
All right, yeah, fair
because
enough.
I'm prepared.
Yeah. You allow everyone else just to kind of rock up and they know that you'll take care of it. Is that how that works?
Yeah, and most of my friends are almost never prepared. And so, Yeah, so I have a rough sketch. There is quite a bit of travel. There are places that I want to see in the world, and that's a priority. Learning how to speak Spanish is a priority. My partner is Mexican, and yeah, I think having a little bit more fluency feels important as we consider, you know, like maybe do we want to live somewhere else in the world? I'm not from the US and I've lived in lots of different places, and I'm itching to spread my wings again. I've been back stateside for 6 years. Right. Is it 7 years? 6 years.
You're itch coming up, as they say.
It is, yes. So there's that. And I think, you know, the other thing that I want to do is I want to meet people who are working on workforce issues in other parts of the world. Like, I want to know, yeah, like, how are you solving for it, you know? And, like, be like, with folks face-to-face in real time. Like, of course I can reach out to folks and set up a Zoom call and, you know, wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning to talk to somebody who's in Thailand. I could do that. But I think that there's something real and really powerful of being in person. And so that's my other big task, is I'm giving myself the goal of meeting people in real life in every city I visit during my sabbatical.
Well, if you come to Germany, I don't live in a big city. I live in a little sort of toy town in Germany. But if you come to Germany, let me know. Hey, look, we're up for time. The final question, the show is named Power of Ten, is named after the Powers of Ten film by Ray and Charles Eames. It's all about the relative size of things in the universe. And I still find it sort of endlessly fascinating, both as a film, but also just kind of, and what it says about ourselves and our world and universe, but also as a way of thinking about different Zoom levels and the kind of difference it makes. So the final question is always, what one small thing that's either overlooked or could be redesigned would have an outsized effect on the world?
One small thing. Ugh, I feel like we need to bring back lunch breaks.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Do you mean it's because of, like, people were working at their desks, or do you mean that when people were working remotely, they kind of don't really take a proper lunch break?
Both. Yeah. I think that there is something about giving yourself a pause. It lets you see your reality a little bit more clearly. And we need to eat. Yeah, right? Like we live in a world of work where like our blood sugar is spiking and crashing constantly, and we're trying to survive off of coffee. And I actually do think that if people took their lunch break, they probably would be a little more brave. I think they would be a little bit more centered, more grounded, and probably happier.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Sleep is another one, I think. I read the other day that America is just behind Japan in being the... No, I think actually America is the worst. The least amount of sleep in the world. Japan's just slightly behind, I think. It's pretty grim. Where can people find you online? I've put your LinkedIn details up there. Anywhere else do you hang out on the interwebs?
I predominantly hang out on LinkedIn, and I write a weekly newsletter that has a little bit of a fan following, and I'm going to be moving it to Substack.
Okay.
And I believe it's just going to be aparnaray.substack.com. So yeah, starting next week, I think you can find me there.
Okay. Well, we'll see you there. Aparna, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. You've been watching and listening to Power of 10 with me, Andy Pollane. You can find more on the podcast feed, wherever you found this one, and now on YouTube. So if you search for my name, or you should find it. I am A Pollane at A Pollane on pkm.social on Mastodon. I am still Ape Elaine on Twitter. How long that's going to last, I don't know. I don't really interact on there. Or just go to polaine.com, polaine.com. You can check out my leadership coaching practice, online courses, and sign up for my now pretty irregular newsletter. I'll see how much I am in competition with a partner called Doctor's Note, which is newsletter.polaine.com. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes or a thumbs up on YouTube. The good thing about YouTube is if you've got any thoughts, any comments, you can put them down in the comments below, or you can just get in touch on my website. All the links will be in show notes. Thanks for listening and watching, and I'll see you next time.